Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is it still hip to be cool? After decades of offering elevated influence and social standing to those who possessed it, coolness today is not what it used to be. Late 20th century marketers worked so hard to use the concept to move product that the word cool is now more likely to be applied to things than people. There's no guarantee that whipping out a cool smartphone or getting around in a cool car will convey any special status to its owner. In fact, Americans in increasing numbers seem to be moving past the ironic detachment required to be cool, searching instead for fulfillment through simplicity and sincerity. The latest book by composer and culture critic Ted Gioia explores this new reality. It's called The Birth and Death of the Cool. Ted, welcome back to Think.
Thank you, Chris. Glad to be back.
So I guess I really do need to ask this. What is cool?
Well, cool, many people think, is a timeless concept. They think cool has always been around. People always want to be cool and always will want to be cool. But in fact, what we know of as the cool is a fairly modern invention. It started in the 1950s. If you go back earlier in the Great Depression or World War II, people were so focused on just surviving that if you told them they had to do it in a cool, stylish way, they would have thought that was a ridiculous concept or even decadent. But once you get their children's generation in the 1950s and the 1960s, people begin to focus on their accessories, the right way of acting, the right way of talking, the right jargon. They really borrow things out of the jazz community, and all of a sudden the age of cool has come upon us.
Let's talk about the origins of the term, because, in fact, it was used first by jazz musicians, this guy who was with the Count Basie Orchestra.
That's right, Lester Young. You know, cool as we know it didn't have the same meaning not long ago. For most of its history, cool has been a negative term. It meant emotional distance, indifference, aloofness. In fact, a linguist told me, and this is hard to believe, but he said in every language, the word for a cold temperature also means sort of a negative emotional state. And even as recently as the 1930s, you know, 1938, Cab Calloway came out with a book called The Hipster's Dictionary to teach people how to talk hip. And you don't find the word cool anywhere in that dictionary. Then 6 years later, Dan Berkeley wrote The Harlem Guide to Jive. And once again, the word cool doesn't show up anywhere in that book. But then all of a sudden in the late 1940s, people start using this word cool to mean hip, stylish, with it. And it really came out of Lester Young, the great saxophonist with the Count Basie Orchestra, a wonderful musician, but also one of the most eccentric people around. And he had his whole personal language. He was the one also started using the word bread to mean money. And in fact, in my book, I give a long list of the little bits of jargon that came from him. But the idea of cool being hip and stylish stuck. And now it's a very common word. Everyone uses it.
Well, this is really interesting because the word is being used no less often than it ever was. But it doesn't mean the same thing today, you don't think?
That's right. It's been demeaned. It's almost a verbal tick. It means anything that's just barely acceptable now is cool. Do you want to get dinner? Cool. Shall we see a movie? Cool. Shall we stay home? Cool. Everything is cool. And so the word has been robbed of a lot of its vibrancy. At the same time, I noticed increasingly people are mocking the word or misspelling it. There's a website called cool.com, spelled C-U-I-L, which is a competitor to Google. And I get these emails now from people spelling it K-E-W-L.
Yeah.
And I think it's part of what I call this backlash against the cool. It's become so commoditized and overused that even the very word now has become demeaned.
Well, it's interesting because it's almost an ironic detachment from this state of ironic detachment.
That's right. We know the essence of cool is irony. It was sort of this hip, indifferent, ironic stance in which it was sort of a contradiction, where you could be emotionally involved in something but also distant and aloof as though it didn't matter. And that was a very exciting combination. Right? I mean, for example, for cool jazz, that was the great balance. Or take someone like Frank Sinatra, who epitomizes the cool. I think what people found attractive in him was his ability to put himself into the emotion of the song, but also sort of make fun of the song at the same time with those little asides, or, you know, he threw out swear words or whatever. But I think people are now moving away from that. One of the key themes I talk about in my book is what I call the new earnestness, the new simplicity, and irony really is out.
The Susan Boyle phenomenon.
Well, that's right. You know, you look at these reality shows, and even just the very existence of reality shows is revealing. What does it mean when millions of people, instead of wanting to see the cool, glamorous star, want to see everyday people like themselves on TV or on Facebook or Twitter. They're sort of this backing away from the cool. And then on these reality shows, the characters they embrace are amazing. I think everyone by now realizes that the cool candidate always loses on American Idol. You know, it's always gray-haired Taylor Hicks from Alabama. You know, he's beating out sultry Catherine McPhee from Los Angeles. Or you have overweight Ruben Stoddard beating out Clay Aiken with his boyish good looks. On Nashville Star, which is sort of a country western equivalent of American Idol, people were amazed the debut season when Buddy Jewell, who was overweight, unattractive, beats out Miranda Lambert, who's like drop-dead gorgeous, but it's because of the raw authenticity of his singing. And then you get to the classic example, which you mentioned, is Susan Boyle, who becomes famous on Britain's Got Talent. And then it seems within hours, she's famous in America. Her YouTube video gets watched tens of millions of times. I think she's got the number one CD in America right now. And she's almost the poster child for uncool. And it's not that, I mean, her singing is just so-so. You know, I'm a music critic by background. She's not the greatest singer. She's an acceptable singer. But what people find so appealing about her is just how uncool she is. And that tells you that a change is happening in our society. And people tell me, well, Ted, this is just another style. And I go, no, it's not another style. It's a rejection of stylishness. And it's not just another trend, but it's a suspicion of trendiness. So really a new wave is coming, and everything's changing as a result.
So you don't see this as just a redefinition of what is cool?
Well, that's right. I think people tend to feel that there are always trends, and whatever is the new trend is the cool trend. But I am proposing that something different is happening right now in our culture, in that people are increasingly suspicious of cool as a defining aspect of their culture or their life. And there's a good reason for this. You know, cool has many benefits to it. And I'll be honest, one of the reasons why I researched it is I, like many people, are attracted to cool. It's such a glamorous concept. But there's a fundamental flaw at the heart of the cool, which is once you decide you're going to live your life according to a cool mandate, all of a sudden you lose control of it because cool truly is in the eyes of the beholder. You may think you have the most righteous hairdo. You may think you have the coolest running shoes, but they need to be validated by other people. They're not really cool unless other people buy into it. So increasingly there's a neurotic quality to cool. And I'm saying that in our current age now, I think we're moving more to an era in which people are driven by their own deeply held values and principles and are less influenced by the flux of the crowd or the marketing messages coming at them.
I want to talk a little bit about the appeal of cool, at least historically, in youth culture. And I wonder if part of that is the fact that you write that traditionally it didn't hurt to have money to be cool, but you didn't necessarily have to have it. And so therefore it was something that everybody could aspire to, whether they were a kid with no job or an older person.
Well, that's right. You know, one of the reasons why cool was so powerful, and I really look at the last half of the 20th century as the age of the cool. Really, when cool took over, it was one of the most profound changes in American personality and psyche in history. And the reason why it was so powerful is that you could transform your life. And it really, if you had money, it helped. Doesn't it always? But in this instance, you didn't need to have money. The promise of cool was if you had the right attitude, the right hip things you were saying, the right way of strutting down the street, you could transform your life. You know, it was, in my mind, it was like the American dream. You know, what America always promised people, and it didn't always deliver, but what it promised people is that you could come here and you could remake your life, and it didn't matter who your dad was. It didn't matter how much money you had in your checking account. It didn't matter what college you went to. The promise of America was that you could reinvent your life from the ground up, from a blank sheet of paper. And cool really reinforced that. And this interesting thing about the cool is that it came from the marginalized people in society, from blacks, from jazz musicians, from bohemians, from beatniks. It's interesting. In my book, I look at the leading people who invented the cool, you know, sort of like the Frank Sinatras and the Chet Bakers and the Miles Davises and the Jack Kerouacs. Virtually all of them are dropouts or never went to college at all. On the other hand, almost all of them got arrested at some point or served time. So what a strange flip-flop. Instead of this great hierarchy of the established powers, all of a sudden people could come from the marginalized reaches and change society. And that was the appeal of it.
Is there anything to the fact that the first generation of Americans who cared about being cool are now, if they are still alive, quite elderly?
Well, I think there's an age change going. Cool really came of life in the late 1950s and then really took off in the 1960s. In the late 1950s, Life magazine did an article, and they estimated that there were 2,000 hipsters in San Francisco, 1,000 in Los Angeles. You know, they added up.
Why do you census take that?
and it was a sort of a corny article, but the idea is there were 10,000 cool people in America in 1959. But 10 years later, all these cool mannerisms and ways of acting and talking really entered the youth culture. And by the time you get into the 1970s, I would say anyone under the age of 30 by then had been changed in some degree by the cool revolution. So really, nowadays, these people are approaching retirement years, and I think really it's the next generation that where you see the renunciation of the cool, most dramatically. I mean, I look at my children. They're so suspicious of these cool marketing messages of things that promise they should be cool. Youth culture gets a bad name. People think that youths are lazy or whatever, but you actually look – they're buying these books of the 7 habits of effective teens and all these self-help books. You know, I think back to my own high school, and I imagine what would have happened to one of my friends if he had shown up with a book called the 7 habits of effective teens. All I could say is I would hope one of those habits would be to run faster than the rest of us, because he would get beat up immediately if he had showed up. But nowadays, there is this new earnestness, this new seriousness among youth culture that I think a lot of people miss, but is one of the defining aspects of what I call post-cool society.
You also write about the fact here that when you were a kid, most of your heroes on TV and in the movies were adults. You had the Lone Ranger and you had Captain Kirk. And nowadays, it's Harry Potter and it's the kids on the Disney Channel, and it's a much younger crowd of heroes that these kids have.
And I think this is part of what I call the death of the cool. When I was growing up, I grew up in the 1960s and 1970s, and the first heroes I had were spies, James Bond or Mission Impossible or whatever, and they were always wearing these tuxedos and drinking martinis and almost defined coolness. And probably the other heroes we had were the astronauts for boys of my generation, and then that played into like Star Wars or Star Trek or whatever. And then I look at my kids, and it's interesting. When I was a youngster, all our heroes were grown-ups, and they tended to be cool grown-ups. For my kids, their heroes are other kids. I mean, Harry Potter is a classic example. The heroes I had when I was growing up didn't have mean teachers and do homework in detention hall, but for my kids, the idea that the hero should be someone just like themselves, I think, is a part of what I call this new earnestness or embracing the real. And I think you saw that change starting in the 1990s. First of all, with maybe Back to the Future, Home Alone was the biggest selling movie of 1999. It was very revealing. The hero was a kid, very much like the kids who were watching it in the movies. And it was only a couple years later that the first reality show came on. And I think these are all part of the same trend where even in entertainment, people want things that are more like themselves, more down to earth, more simple, more like what they would encounter in their own day-to-day lives.
Did coolness, Ted, require an equal and opposite amount of uncoolness in order to thrive?
Well, cool always tries to set itself up against something. The coolness was always against the establishment, against the powers that be. And that's another one of the reasons why I think cool as a cultural concept is exhausted, is the people that we've rebelled against, they have co-opted cool. Cool increasingly is a corporate endeavor. In the 1950s, if I had asked people what they thought of when they thought of cool, they would have mentioned a person like Miles Davis or James Dean. I think it's revealing now when you ask people about cool, they usually mention a product like an iPod or an iPhone.
Ted Gioia is my guest. His new book is called The Birth and Death of the Cool. We'll resume our conversation in a moment, and you can get on the line now to join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or go online and send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is composer and culture critic Ted Gioia. His newest book is called The Birth and Death of the Cool. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. You point out that by the late 70s, the whole culture had gone cool, and that left very little room for anything to react against. And that was basically the beginning of the end.
Well, that's right. You know, cool became so pervasive, and cool wanted to be an outsider. I mean, it all came from the outsiders, sort of the jazz musicians and bohemians. But once everyone is cool, everyone's got the same shoe with the same logo, everyone has adopted these mannerisms and accessories, inevitably a backlash will set in. I think it's interesting. There was a market researcher back in the 1970s and 80s named Arnold Mitchell. He's completely ignored nowadays. You won't even find his name in Wikipedia. But I found that the research he did in the early 1980s really predicted exactly the premise of my book, which was there was going to be a backlash against the cool, and that all these attempts to market it would eventually fall by the wayside as people got suspicious and increasingly distrustful of them.
Yeah, the marketing is really fascinating, and you have a whole segment where you talk about big corporations who have at least at this point learned that maybe it's not working to just be a big corporation. So then they sneak in, and Coca-Cola buys Odwalla, the organic juice maker, and Walmart is selling all these products that used to be found only in specialty markets.
Well, that's right. You know, as I mentioned in my book, I talk about a new environment of life after cool in which people want things that are more natural, more down to earth. There's suspicious of the big companies. They want things that are small. And you look at the way the corporations are responding to it, it's fascinating. Let me give you an example. There's a company called Naked Juice, and their motto is, you know, there's nothing to hide, you know, nothing hidden here. But in fact, if you go to their website, you'll find perfectly hidden the fact is that they're owned by Pepsi. And this is, I find, interesting, because if you look over the last 20, 30 years, no company has spent more on getting endorsements of cool celebrities than Pepsi. I mean, they've gotten endorsements from Beyonce and Shakira and, you know, Britney Spears and Michael Jackson, and it was back then Ray Charles, David Beckham. You know, you just name it, they've gotten endorsement from it. And now they have to hide their brand name? I think that's very revealing that the company that did the most to be cool now feels they have to hide their brand name. And there are many other examples of this. You know, for example, let's take Budweiser. Budweiser spends more money on Super Bowl advertising than anybody, $15 million per year just on commercials during the Super Bowl. Yet for the last decade, every year, Budweiser has lost market share to these microbreweries that do virtually no advertising and are just sort of small, down-to-earth, natural. Now, what does it tell you when people decide they want to buy the brand of beer that's not advertised on the Super Bowl? So there's a big change happening afoot in marketing. Probably the best measure of it is to look in the corporations itself. You know what the most tenuous job in the corporate suite now is? The chief marketing officer. Most companies replace their head of marketing every 27 months on average now. That is the shortest tenure of any job. The CEO lasts for 5 years on average. Every other job lasts for at least 5 or 6 years. But companies are constantly firing the head of marketing. And why is that? It's because these techniques they've used to manipulate the cool and to try to change people's concepts of the cool just don't work anymore. And they keep on firing the head of marketing. But that doesn't really address the underlying problem, which is these methods need to change.
Do you think that the Budweisers and the Pepsis of the world are just biding their time, hoping for a resurgence of cool?
I think the smarter companies have become even more secretive and manipulative. They realize they need to look like a small company. They need to act less cool than they did before. But the way they do it is very duplicitous. Let me give you another example. There's a singer named Mary Digby. And about 2-3 years ago, she became very famous overnight. She had these YouTube videos that everybody saw. And if you saw these videos, it shows her at her apartment singing, playing the guitar. The apartment's messed up. Even behind her, you can see the door to the bathroom open. It's sort of like toiletries on the bathtub. I mean, you can't get more down to earth than this.
Looks homemade.
It looks absolutely homemade. And tens of millions of people saw this. And then the Wall Street Journal broke the story that, in fact, this was all staged by Disney. A subsidiary of them had signed her to a record contract, and they wanted to make it look like a grassroots effort. But if you went to her MySpace page, and she said what label she was on, she would say she didn't have a label. But in fact, they were preparing her album for release, and they were trying to pretend as it was a grassroots effort. And I would say, what a contrast from the old days. You know, when I was coming up, if a musician got signed to a major label, they would shout it at the top of the hills. I mean, what could be more important than to be this cool star with a major label? I think it's very revealing now that if you want to be successful in music, you try to hide those things and you try to appear as down-to-earth as possible. I think this is a sign that, in fact, our attitudes towards cool have undergone a fundamental change.
Ted Gioia is my guest. The new book is called The Birth and Death of the Cool. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go to Laura in Corsicana. Hey, Laura.
Hi. I have this strange question that has to do with the Clinton years and those scandals. There was a point when he went on MTV and he was asked the question of whether he wore boxers or briefs. And I was wondering sort of how that affected our whole concept of cool.
That's a good question. In fact, politics, this was playing out in a very fascinating way. And I think it reinforces this idea that cool is going out of style. If you go back to the early 1990s, when Bill Clinton ran for president, he got on Arsenio Hall's show. He put on sunglasses. He played the saxophone, all these cool trappings. On MTV, he talked about whether he wore boxers or briefs. Well, those days are gone. And if you look now, I talk about this in my book, what I call the new earnestness. Candidates aren't going to do that anymore because they realize there's a backlash against it. Interestingly enough, during the last campaign, Barack Obama was asked a question during an interview about what kind of underwear he wore. And his answer was very to the point. He says, I don't answer questions like that. And I think it's a measure of how much things have changed that both politicians in the last presidential election worked hard to portray themselves as uncool as possible.
And the McCain campaign also went out of its way to point out that Barack Obama was cool. They thought it would help them that the other guy was cool.
Well, that's right. It's interesting. They did these attack ads, and they showed pictures of Barack Obama. Then they would show, like, Paris Hilton and Britney Spears, and they were trying to portray Obama as very cool. Now, first of all, it was interesting. What people would say, well, what's so wrong with being cool? But in fact, obviously, the McCain people had done research, and they realized that whereas 10, 15 years ago, being cool would have helped a presidential candidate, they realized that the tables have turned. And also, McCain, for his part, tried to be as uncool as possible. I mean, what could be less cool than picking for your running mate a moose-hunting mayor of Wasilla, Alaska? And it was almost like this battle between the two candidates to see who could be the most sober, the most serious, and the most earnest.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have an email here from Russ in Irving to think@kera.org. Says, classic nerdy Gen Xer here. His comment about having to run fast really hits home, as I actually had to learn to fight in seventh grade because I was in chess club. Nerds learn to make money, though, and I always thought that nerds had reigned victorious.
Well, I think the time of the nerd has finally arrived. And you see it everywhere.
A cheer resounds throughout the NPR studios.
That's right. I know, NPR audience, your day has finally arrived. Nerds have become heroes in an odd way. Over the last 5 years, there have been a half dozen shows on networks in which the hero is a nerd, whether it's, you know, The Big Bang Theory or Ugly Betty. A whole host of these shows have
even dating shows.
Dating shows, Chuck, The Beauty and the Geek. At the same time, all these books have come out on, you know, how to marry a nerd or whatever. You know, at the rate we're going now, I'm not exactly predicting that, you know, Stephen Hawking or Bill Gates is going to replace, you know, Tom Cruise or Justin Timberlake on the cover of People magazine. I mean, we're not quite at that level yet, but clearly a change is in the air, and that this whole nerdiness thing has turned around. Let me give one more example. When I was growing up, there was this group called Junior Achievement, which took children and tried to turn them into little business managers. And when I was growing up, it was very derided at least the schools I went to, sort of the inner city schools. You know, you'd get beat up if you were like, you know, decided you're going to be like Junior Achievement. Well, nowadays, it's one of the most successful programs at schools and has had more growth in the last 10, 15 years than in the previous half century. And so it tells you that a change is afoot. And sort of all the nerds and geeks of the world, finally, you know, they're going to inherit the earth.
Yeah, I was actually reading something the other day about the fact that National Honor Society, they're trying to figure out what to do because so many kids are getting in now because they care about their grades and they're actually applying themselves, that they're not quite sure if it means what it used to mean.
Well, that's right. Go to Amazon.com and look at the most purchased books by youngsters. And you'll be amazed at how many of the books there are these books on how to organize their time, how to be productive, habits towards success. And then look at the number of organizations out there to help student entrepreneurs. It's not just Junior Achievement. There are literally 20, 30 organizations out there now that are going to people at a very young age and teaching them about various aspects of management and responsibility that, you know, once again, I think back to my own generation coming up in the 60s and 70s, that would have been unthinkable.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Leo in Arlington. Hi, Leo.
Hi there. Well, my question is this. I heard you earlier in the show use the word hipsters, referring to cool people in the mid-20th century. I think it's interesting, though, in youth culture now, that word has a different meaning. It sort of refers to a subculture that exists of people who are kind of anti-fashion or intentionally or ironically uncool. And I just was wondering if you thought that was somehow related to what you've described as the death of the cool.
Well, that's, you know, there's this whole idea of it's hip to be square, and it's almost sort of a paradox. But I think you can see this trend in many aspects of culture and accessories. People that previously would have been the trendiest of the trendy are now the ones that are being the most vocal and vehement in embracing things that are almost deliberately uncool, you know, whether these big Buddy Holly kind of eyeglasses. You know, they look like a brand like Hush Puppies, which was totally uncool for many years, will all of a sudden find it has a resurgence in sales because people are embracing it precisely because it seems to symbolize a rejection of coolness. And this is a very fascinating topic because there's still an element of the cool here. People are still trying to set the tone with their accessories and sort of their lifestyle messages. But they're doing it in ways that are a rejection of what the mass market is doing.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next here to Heidi in Dallas. Hello, Heidi.
Hi, this is Heidi. And I just had a question about how the decline of cool. You've been talking about children and students the last few questions. But are students really still having the confidence, or do they have the confidence to kind of be uncool, like specifically teenagers and children, when it comes to outside of academics, but like with fashion, what you were just talking about?
Well, you know, there's always going to be peer pressure and people jumping on bandwagons and people, you know, embracing something that's trendy. And I'm not suggesting that trendiness will disappear or that people aren't going to pay attention to that. But I think what you're finding is increasingly, even youngsters are going to be more driven by their own personal code of values rather than constantly adapting what they do to the pressures of the crowd. And I think you see this obviously in the academics, but I think you see it in a whole host of other ways as well. But ultimately, this is going to play out on a larger scale in many spheres. Let me just give you one example from youth culture, which are these Japanese cartoons, these manga, these anime books that are very popular with the younger set. They're almost the antithesis of coolness from the perspective of the parents. The parents can't understand these things because these comic books seem so flat, they seem so one-dimensional, and they don't have sort of the cool, flashy trappings that we associate with youth culture. But I think this is, you know, one example of many that I could give of things in youth culture that puzzle the parents that grew up in the age of cool and the baby boomer generation as they see their children embrace these things. And we mentioned before, like Harry Potter or these other movies, they're embracing things that don't have quite the same cool panache. So, yes, there's still the trends out there. There's still fashions. People are still embracing the fashions. But when you see what actually these fashions are, you realize, in fact, that something profound has changed with the younger generation.
Do you think there's something to the fact that schools today tend to be kinder, gentler places than they were when we were growing up? I mean, when I was a kid, I didn't go to a violent school, but playground fights were not unusual. These days, that is the talk of a school for weeks and weeks, and there's sort of zero tolerance for anything like that. And kids are not necessarily socialized to be, you know, Lord of the Flies.
Well, that's right. Because of the tolerance, people can make less of a statement now than before. You know, when I was growing up, I had to wear a uniform at my school for the first 8-9 years. Until I got into high school, I wasn't allowed to choose my own clothing. And in an environment like that, to be able to represent your lifestyle through your accessories and what you wear is a lot more important than nowadays, when almost anything goes and everything's fine. And I think because of the less strict and more tolerant attitudes that permeate the educational system, once again, that demeans the concept of cool even further, because once again, you know, people have this freedom, and so they don't. It's harder and harder to make these anti-establishment statements.
Do you think it comes as a relief to people to not have to sort of create a lifestyle, to just go forth and live a life?
Well, this whole concept of lifestyle is fascinating. I would argue that the whole age of cool in the last half of the 20th century was linked to the emergence of lifestyle. That was another word that didn't exist in the 1920s and 1930s. If I had gone to my parents, who grew up in the Great Depression, and I had said, you know, Mom, Dad, you really need to pay more attention to your lifestyle, you know, they would have looked at me like I was crazy. Here's a measure. 1967, the Chicago Tribune, during the course of the entire year, only used the word lifestyle 7 times. 5 years later, that same newspaper used the word lifestyle more than 3,000 times. And today, not only do you see the word lifestyle on almost every page of the paper, but newspapers even have what they call lifestyle editors. That's a common job description at the newspaper, is the lifestyle editor. So really, the last half of the 20th century was the age of lifestyle. But I think we're seeing a backlash against that, and that even the concept of lifestyle, I heard a commentator recently say, and this was on NPR actually, that it focused on the triviality of small differences. So there's a rejection of lifestyle along with this rejection of the cool.
Ted Gioia is my guest this hour. We're talking about his new book, The Birth and Death of the Cool. We'll take more of your calls after the break. You can get to us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's continuing and professional education. Hundreds of non-credit personal enrichment and professional development courses begin this spring. Details online at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is composer and culture critic Ted Gioia. His newest book is called The Birth and Death of the Cool. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Ken in Fort Worth. Hi, Ken.
Hi. Yeah, my question was, is how much did, or if any of the European cultures of the 40s and 50s had any influence on what became known as American cool today? You were talking about how jazz musicians came up with those words, and seeing how they traveled to Europe to tour, if they brought back any of that European culture back to America and later, you know, became known as American cool.
Thanks for your call.
It's interesting that the Europeans in many ways understood the significance of much of this even before Americans did. You know, I write in my book how cool came out of the jazz culture. And really, the jazz culture found its first serious audience overseas. The first real jazz biography was written by Robert Goffin, who was a Belgian. The first jazz discography was put together by Charles Delaunay, who was French. The first jazz magazines appeared in Europe. The first jazz festivals appeared in Europe. And in general, they understood the importance and significance of this before the Americans did. Now, on the other hand, the Americans really set much of the cultural tone and created this great flowering of music, movies, media, and the like. But the Europeans picked up on it. And in film as well, you know, one of the most astute reviews of James Dean, who was really like the first cool celebrity movie star, comes from Truffaut, who was writing about him, in France at the time East of Eden came out. So really, the Europeans were key in terms of being able to define, conceptualize, and understand the significance of a lot of what the Americans were doing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Tyler in Plano. Hello, Tyler.
Hello.
How are you
guys doing?
Great, thank you.
Hey, I before I jump into my question, I wanted to make just a quick comment. You know, as I'm anticipating talking to you guys, I can feel my heart and speed up and everything. So I guess that's not very cool of me to get nervous before going on the air. But my question is, you mentioned earlier in the show that cool used to be figures like James Dean or Miles Davis, and now it's kind of become iPods or Ed Hardy T-shirts. And I was wondering if you would say that cool has become more purchasable in our current society.
Well, it has become more purchasable, but it's become degraded at the same time. I think it's interesting that if you look at all the companies and try to find the ones that have done the most to try to capture the cool ethos of the 1950s, you know, sort of this whole James Dean, Marlon Brando, Miles Davis, the company that has used that most in its advertising is The Gap. I mean, they even went to the point of putting Jack Kerouac or Miles Davis's picture in ads. But I think it's revealing that if you talk to young people and ask them what they think about The Gap, they find it a completely unstylish place to go shopping. I know a Wall Street analyst was talking about The Gap recently, and he said, what's The Gap? It's a store that young people won't go into. So I think it's revealing that the very companies that try the most to try to co-opt the cool are the ones which there's a great backlash against. A classic example of this would be Nike as well, in which there was all this backlash about third world labor. And just look at this whole Tiger Woods scandal. You know, I'm not going to get into all the nitty gritty of that. This is NPR after all. But this whole idea that buying coolness by having a celebrity endorse your product, that was already on the decline before this Tiger Woods fiasco. And I think it's very revealing that companies that thought they could just buy coolness by putting a logo or a person's name on a product are now realizing that has as much downside as upside.
We have an email here from Mike in Plano who says, cool is also very wasteful of resources. Chasing the latest trends means constantly overbuying. I would hope that some of the rejection of cool is also a realization that we don't have to overextend ourselves at every turn and be consumer slaves.
Well, that's right. And I write about this at length in my book, how sort of this sustainability movement, the eco-friendly movement, is contributing to the death of the cool. Let me compare two magazines that came out in the late 1990s. This is really revealing. The biggest magazine launch in history took place in the late 1990s when Tina Brown came out with this magazine called Talk. Talk wasn't cheap. I mean, they spent $50 million to launch this. Every cool celebrity was at the launch party. It tried to be the coolest of the cool in terms of magazine culture. And it was a fiasco. The magazine went out of business. It couldn't find readers. It lost a huge amount of money. And the same time it came out, another magazine was launched with no fanfare, called Real Simple. And Real Simple focused on teaching people to have simple, sustainable lives. And when it came out, people laughed at it. They said, oh, this is a ridiculous notion. We need a magazine to tell us that. But in fact, as Talk became a fiasco, Real Simple became a huge success and even went on TV on PBS starting in 2006. And it was revealing to me that the magazine that tried to be cool lost money and went out of business. And the one that looked at sort of the sustainability and simplicity angle is the one that's really captured the audience.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Daniel in Dallas. Hey, Daniel.
Hey, how are you guys doing?
Great, thank you.
I have a quick question for your guest. In his research for this book, if he took a notice to the punk movement in the 70s when a lot of musicians were this do-it-yourself attitude came about, and a lot of musicians were turning their backs on big names, big brands and such. And that movement, the punk movement, slowly became commercialized. And a more, I guess, recent trend would be the rise of indie rock music in the 90s and early 21st century. And you can look at the music scene for a lot of these Wow, lost my train of thought.
That's okay. I think we've got your point.
Yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. In fact, I devote a whole chapter. It's actually the longest chapter in my book on popular music. And I think popular music is very important in understanding cultural trends. You know how economists have what they call the leading indicators, and it's what they look at to try to predict the future. Well, I've always said if you want to look at the leading cultural indicators, just turn on the radio. It's a 24/7 guide that helps you understand the psyche of America. And I would argue that every major cultural trend of the last century has been announced on the radio before it showed up in most people's day-to-day lives. I mean, if you were listening to Bob Dylan in 1962 sing A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall, this was before the Gulf of Tonkin Resolution. It was before the, you know, hippies and protests and all that. But you heard it there first, just as in 1937, if you'd listened to Benny Goodman, you would have understood what was going on before it hit the mainstream culture. And I think you look at, and I talk about punk rock in the book, I talk about indie rock, the singer-songwriters, and I ask, what do you see now if you listen to popular music? And I think what you find again is there's a rejection of the cool and the glamorous, and there's a tremendous mismatch with what the industry wants to give people. The music industry wants to promote the coolest and glamorous stars, but what people are looking for are the ones that aren't so cool and glamorous. And I've talked about Susan Boyle, but there are other examples as well. You know, Norah Jones sold 20 million records doing music that sounded like it was written in the 1920s or 30s. And in some instances, it was. It was really of down-to-earth, simple, earnest. Another example is Ava Cassidy, a great singer who died of cancer in the 1990s, but actually went on to sell 10 million records in the new millennium. Once again, it was almost a rejection of the cool pose in her music, but it was embraced by people. And I give a number of examples in my book of everything from the soundtrack to Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, the Buena Vista Social Club, these recordings of Gregorian chant. It seems every year some record comes out that sells 10 million copies that completely shocks and surprises the music industry, but it's because they don't understand that a shift has taken place in the American personality. And this cool trend that they're trying to push that worked 20 years ago, hey, it doesn't work anymore.
Well, there's also this democratizing effect of new technology in that you can find really obscure artists and you can collect their whole catalog without having to go to the big shiny record store on the corner.
Everybody is bypassing the music industry. And they can do it through MySpace. They can do it through YouTube. But there's this idea now that if you want to find the great music nowadays, the belief people have, and I think it's true to a certain extent, is you need to bypass these arbiters of cool that are in the big offices, and you go directly to the source. And through the wonders of the Internet, you're able to do that. You know, I review music. And, you know, last year people sent me more than 1,000 CDs to review. So I'm almost overwhelmed by it at times. But I'm amazed when I go through this, I find that the real happening music now, in my opinion, is the stuff that the suits in the skyscrapers don't know about.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Tony in Plano. Hi, Tony.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Okay, thank you. I'm just curious if this is the end of cool, whether now is the right time to sell one's black, Apple and Starbucks stock if one is a holder of such hip stocks.
Well, you know, it's interesting. I do talk about the stock market in my book, and you mentioned Starbucks. It was interesting. Throughout its history, Starbucks spent no money on advertising. Virtually none. They spent 1% of sales on advertising compared to Coca-Cola that spent 10% on sales.
No TV ads until last year.
That's right. And when they announced that they were going to start doing lots of advertising to enhance their image or their coolness of image, the stock fell 38% in the next 6 months. During a period in which its competitors like Green Mountain Coffee or Pete's, actually their stock went up. And I think you're seeing this more and more, is the harder the company tries to be cool, the less the market embraces it. Almost the most amazing exception to this is Apple. And it seems almost inevitable. If I had to predict one thing, it seems to me inevitable there's going to be an Apple backlash at some point in the next 5-10 years. It's the last company out there that is really pushing the cool mandate and seems to be completely immune to criticism and everybody loves it. So if I look at one exception that seems just to stand out there that seems to say the age of cool is still here, it's Apple, and I think it'll be very interesting to see what happens over the next 5-10 years.
What tells you that, to paraphrase, post-cool is less fickle and less changeable than cool?
Well, you know, people increasingly are being motivated, as I say, by their own deeply held values and principles. And there are many good things about it, but one of the things that's not so good is sort of this increasing amount of anger in our society. It's a bad thing when a whole culture loses its cool. And we see that now. We really live in a culture of confrontation. Obviously, talk radio, obviously, town hall meetings, whatever. You know what one of the fastest growing professions in America is right now? It's anger management counseling. This didn't exist as a profession when I was a child, but nowadays it's big business. And I think it's testimony to the fact that more and more people are losing their cool. So I think although the age of cool is gone and the new age has some good aspects to it in terms of this earnestness, this eco-friendly aspect of it, this the whole seriousness of it, there is a downside to it as more and more people lose their cool. And this may create, I believe, another change in the American personality in another 10 or 15 years. Because there's also some bad karma at the heart of the contemporary culture.
Do you think cool could have a resurgence?
I think cool as we know it is gone. And as I talk about, there's a post-cool age here, life after cool. But I don't think the life after cool is going to last forever. As I mentioned, I think it too will be replaced. And what replaces it may have some of the elements of the old cool. But I think the cool as we know it, the whole James Dean, Miles Davis, Marlon Brando, you know, Steve McQueen, Paul Newman kind of cool. I don't think that will ever come back. But I know I will be nostalgic for it because it's something I think we all look back on with a lot of fondness.
Are we better off as individual members of a society in a time when it doesn't matter quite so much if you're cool?
I think for the most part, this change that's permeating our culture, I think mostly is a positive one. In my book, I talk about different lifestyles that are all post-cool lifestyles. They're all lifestyles after the cool. And we've talked about some of them already, sort of the eco-friendly, sort of the – and the media really tries to grasp at names. And they talk about NASCAR dads or soccer moms. And even they find it difficult to pin it down. But all these have something in common, and it's this – focus on people, you know, what Voltaire called cultivating their own garden or leading their own lives based on their own principles and values. And, you know, that has to be a good thing for society as a whole, you know. So I will miss the cool. I think all of us will have some nostalgia for that great age of cool. But there's many good things about a life in which we're all focused more on our own lives, our own internally held values.
Ted Gioia's latest book is called The Birth and Death of the Cool. Ted, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Chris. It's been a delight.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.